Trauma-proofing your children. What is trauma? I'm sure you've heard the word, but what does it really mean in our lives? Is trauma just the big things, the big, big disasters that happen to some people when they go through a tsunami or when they are in a terrible accident, heaven forbid, or when they've come back from war? We know that trauma, the word trauma, does apply to some people who've gone through terrifying situations, although, interestingly, it doesn't apply to everyone who's gone through even those kinds of situations. So some people coming out of a tsunami, a flood, a hurricane, a disaster, a natural disaster, actually get traumatized. And yet some people will be fine. What does it mean to be traumatized in a situation like that? Trauma is a circuit in the body that is not turning off. And we're going to explore why that is in a few moments, just looking at the psychobiology of trauma. But what happens is that when a person has been in a natural disaster like a flood, or some other kind of man-made disaster like a war or a terrorist attack, then it's as if the body never left the scene. So even though the person physically does leave the scene, their mind and their physiology is stuck in time. And that has a lot of specific consequences. A lot of symptoms come out of that. We know that people do come back from war and they can no longer function. Sometimes when they've been really traumatized, they're so severely depressed or having psychotic symptoms that they can't hold on to their jobs, they lose their marriages, and all kinds of very deep and severe consequences can happen from being traumatized. Now, children are the most vulnerable group when it comes to trauma, because trauma occurs in situations where a person feels completely overwhelmed and completely helpless. Kids have that feeling more often than adults because, in reality, kids are helpless more often than adults. They just don't have the knowledge, the resources, the physical strength to save themselves from a lot of situations. So they are more vulnerable to becoming traumatized. The reason this happens is because the trauma response is initiated by the fight or flight response in the body. When we go through something that we perceive to be an emergency, adrenaline is released. And adrenaline causes a lot of symptoms that are helpful. Actually, they're meant to be life-preserving at the time of a danger. So we have shallow respiration and our saliva kind of dries up, our pupils dilate, our blood clotting operation becomes more ready. Blood flow is drawn away from the skin, so we turn pale. And our digestive tract is slowed down, or just like an end is put to digestion rather quickly, so we sometimes will have momentary diarrhea or stomach upset. There's many processes in the body that get the large muscles ready for fight or flight and turn off the non-essential processes at that time. Everything is geared towards survival. Now, it's fight, flight, or freeze. And freeze happens when a person feels that there's actually no ability to escape, that fleeing is impossible and fighting is impossible. And therefore, the body goes into a freeze position, stands very, very still, doesn't move. And because of children's helplessness, they are the ones more often to find themselves in the freeze position. In that position, they may be physically still, they may be psychologically numb. Sometimes children will describe later on that they have actually left their bodies and are watching the whole scene from somewhere on the ceiling. So this is a common response, actually. We won't go into how that happens right now, but if a child cannot escape, it seems that he is protected psychologically in the moment by not necessarily having to experience everything in the moment. Well, the problem is that when the trauma is over, if the child survives whatever it is, the body is still holding all the effects of adrenaline. So while the adrenaline was pumping through and getting the body ready to flee or to fight, so much energy is pumped through the system, and now it has nowhere to go. It cannot be released. So what happens is it stays inside and circulates. when a situation happens again that has any of the similar features of the original trauma, then the whole circuit will fire again and all the adrenaline will start to get released again. And that, in fact, is what being traumatized means. It means that in ordinary, everyday situations that are not threatening, all of a sudden the body is going into an emergency response. You know, for example, let's say, well, they say talk about soldiers all the time who heard gunfire, and they're walking down the street, and a car backfires, and it sounds kind of similar. And all of a sudden, the soldier is physically, physiologically, psychologically back in the middle of the battlefield, and his heart is racing, and he feels like his life is being threatened, and he's back in time because the trauma pathway has been laid down in the brain through the constant recirculation of this energy that never got released. Now, it would be great if trauma was something that didn't happen to most of us, but in fact, trauma can be caused not just by these life-altering events like war and molestation and being held up at gunpoint, you know, things like that, yes, do cause trauma in some people, but there are everyday events, common, ordinary events, that can also lead to a trauma response. For example, medical procedures where a child particularly, but it can happen to adults as well, is strapped down or tied down, in other words, helpless, and is being hurt. And the younger the child is when this is happening, the less the child understands why he's being hurt, the more likely it is that he can develop a trauma response. So even little babies who are pre-verbal, who are being hurt, their brains may hold a trauma response, and their behavior can manifest this later, which we'll take a look at. Accidents, including falling off a high chair or just having a fall of any kind, hurting oneself, needing stitches, the process of receiving the stitches, dental work, getting regular needles, witnessing injury or aggression of other people. So let's say a child who's sitting nicely on his school bus, but looking out the window, sees something, you know, very frightening happening outside. Sometimes children can actually be traumatized in their classrooms by a teacher who is severely berating another child, not the child himself, but we have a child who gets traumatized vicariously. Same thing can happen in the family where perhaps there's a very bad interaction going on between a parent and another child, and the witnessing child gets traumatized, and possibly the victim child as well. The list of what could traumatize a person, amusement park rides, animals, just anything scary. And we know that little children actually are so vulnerable that even watching a movie, a scary program, or hearing a scary story read to them can traumatize those who are particularly susceptible. That group of children may have a more vivid imagination, or they may carry some extra anxiety genes. Because as I said before, even severely violent, aggressive, life-threatening events do not automatically traumatize everybody. The people who are more likely to be traumatized, especially as we get older, in other words, from the teen years onwards, are people who have anxiety genes, that is, in their family tree, they're a little bit more prone to anxious feelings of different kinds. People who have had previous traumas that have not been fully healed, and people who have less support and less proper interventions that happen right after the trauma, because there are things that we can do to prevent trauma from settling in. And in fact, that's what today's talk is all about, how to help your child so that trauma does not settle in. So let's look at what we can do using the work of Dr. Peter Levine, who is a trauma specialist. He's outlined some events that some steps actually that parents can take to help their children not develop a broken record inside their brain, right? So we're going to look at 8 steps that we can take, and when we take these steps, we're going to help the child move through a scary response so that Once the child moves through the response, it doesn't stay stuck in his body. If, on the other hand, we don't help a child after he's had a very frightening response, a frightening experience, then what can happen is that that panic response, as I said before, will stay in the body, and the child can be what we call triggered at similar times or similar circumstances to the original trauma. But the child, it may not only be that. It can be also that the child develops a post-traumatic stress disorder syndrome, which means that the trauma circuit is activated all the time, not just when the child is triggered by something that reminds him of the original trauma. And in the post-traumatic syndrome, we see that children and adults would have unexplained anxiety, maybe panic attacks going on, probably have sleep disturbances, that they have a fear of going to sleep, where they don't stay asleep, they wake up many times during the night, probably with nightmares and frightening dreams that they can't explain. Sometimes in a post-traumatic disorder, we have mood issues, anger problems, low mood. And in children particularly, this will be manifested as behavioral problems, although in adults who have this, they're also quite irritable and perhaps aggressive and unpleasant to live with, which is why the war veterans, sometimes their marriages break up. They're just unable to be calm and nice and happy like they were before. In children, hyperactivity is also a symptom that can be caused or aggravated by post-traumatic symptoms. And as the child gets older, teenagers on, onward even to traumatized adults, addictions can be a symptom that happens where the person is really trying to self-medicate. And even a child actually can have addictions, but not of the kind that we think of in teenagers. A child may develop all sorts of inappropriate self-soothing activities because their system is just over-aroused all the time, and they're trying to calm down. So, that list again, a child has had a bad incident, or it was bad for the child. The parent may not have even known about the incident, or may not have recognized it as an overwhelming incident as far as the child was concerned. But something happened in the child's brain, and the child's behavior changes to a more anxious, disturbed, and problematic personality. So that's definitely something that we want to prevent, because the child who we're seeing this in may actually be a regular, very sweet person who has, who used to have a very nice personality. So we want to keep it that way. Now, even something like falling off a slide or, something in the playground can cause a trauma response. And this is what we as parents want to know, that when we run over to a child and say, oh, it's okay, just brush yourself off. Okay, go play, what we're doing is we're encouraging the brain of that child to hold on to the trauma response in the body. And we're, not sure, I'm not saying that a full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder is going to happen because the child fell off the slide, but it might. That's one thing that we need to be aware of, that it actually might. Or that the child develops fears and things that get in the way later, that he develops a little panic issue. For example, there's lots of adults who can't explain to themselves why, at a certain stage, maybe they're 20 or 30 or 40 years old, but all of a sudden they're afraid to get on an elevator. And it wasn't a lifelong fear. Things happen later. And this is one of the interesting characteristics of post-traumatic stress disorder. The word post in PTSD means that the body waits and waits and waits, and then later on, when it's good and ready, it manifests the trauma that happened years ago and often decades ago. It's quite an interesting feature of the mind that it will do this, but it seems to wait for a safe enough time. And then all of a sudden, the person is having panic and anxiety in adulthood that they have no idea where it's coming from. The more parents get in the habit of helping children process minor traumas like embarrassing situations and scary situations, when the parent helps the child do that, they're actually laying down another kind of neural pathway in the brain, one that will help the child process all sorts of stress, even when the parent is no longer present or part of that experience, so that the brain itself will know how to process trauma, and then the child becomes an adult who is much more trauma-proof. That's, you know, things can happen, and things do happen. That's just the way life is. It's inescapable. But resilience can be built into the neural pathways, or certainly helped along. So that's what we want to do. Let's go back to our 8 steps of Dr. Levine's protocol for helping children. So let's say a child has experienced a fall, and he's quite shaken up. So what we want to do is, first of all, pay attention to ourselves. Unless the child, you know, is in such a state that the first thing we have to do is call an ambulance, okay? In which case, the first thing we'll do is call the ambulance, right? But if the child has had a fall, take a moment and take a full, deep, slow breath and just center your own body. And the reason for that, the reason why this is called step one of this it's called emotional first aid. That's what Dr. Levine calls it. The reason where we want to do that is because the parent's anxiety is catchy. And what the child needs when the child has been overwhelmed or frightened or shocked, had some sort of upsetting incident, what the child needs is to draw on the calm, secure strength of the parent. So the last thing the child needs is a hysterical parent, somebody who's all upset and flustered and not able to regulate their own anxiety. So take a moment and bring yourself into a grounded position, which means literally pay attention to your feet on the floor so that your energy is brought down to the practical level. The opposite of that, the word ungrounded, means that we're just scattered. We're all over the place. Our energy is up at the top of our head or above our head, sort of. And we're not able to function very well because our mind is going in 1,000 directions. Whereas if we bring ourselves down to earth, see, these phrases are meaningful, coming down to earth and being grounded, having our feet on the floor. All of this means that we're ready to take action in this world. We're ready to take steps. So we want to pay attention, look at your feet, take a slow, deep breath in, and maybe even tell yourself, you know, I'm going to help my child now. And of course, it's always appropriate to ask Hashem for help and guidance and just, you know, to give you the right words and to help your child recover quickly. Step two. Go over to the child and assess him, you know, physically. Just make sure that he is okay and that you don't need to do any emergency activity on the physical level, calling ambulances and so on. If he seems to be okay, then what you want to do is name the feeling just very briefly. Acknowledge what just happened. For example, you could say, "Whoa, that was scary." Okay, just, you know, commenting on his fall. What that does, naming the feeling, actually puts a container around that feeling. Because a child who is overwhelmed or in shock or dazed, which you could notice by the fact that his pupils are dilating, that his skin is white, that he looks shaken, that he might be trembling, those are all consequences of the adrenaline running through his body. So what you want to do is name the incident so that it kind of holds it to a smaller part of life. It becomes less overwhelming. And you say, "That was scary. I'm just going to sit here with you for a few minutes before you go back to play. Let's just sit and wait for a moment." At this step too, you are encouraging the child to give himself a moment to let the energy move out of his system. See, all of that adrenaline is running through his system right now. And it will find its way into his brain where it will create a neural pathway unless you help it discharge itself appropriately. So we're going to help the child process it. We're just going to save the child. Let's just wait a moment. The step three, when your child seems to be physically settling down as if the adrenaline is no longer running and his color seems to be coming back to his face and he's breathing a little bit more normally and he's looking fine, then you want him to pay attention to what's going on inside of his body. And so you just ask him now to pay attention to his body, asking him, how do you feel? How is your body? What's it like inside of you right now? And then you can ask him more specifically, how's your tummy? How's your head doing? And whatever he says, you simply repeat back to him. He says, I'm okay, I'm okay. You say, your tummy's okay? Yeah. And your head's okay? Yeah. Okay, so you're just letting the child, you know, notice that. If this is a teenager that you're dealing with, then of course, you know, be a little bit more sophisticated about that. Honey, just take a moment and just check inside. Is your, you know, is your abdomen feeling okay? How's your neck and shoulders? Are they okay? You know, and just have the child sort of do a body scan. Step four. This one is about slowing yourself down, asking these questions again, but or just giving him time, giving the child time, waiting a minute or 2 minutes between each question, and just say, okay, you know, how's the arms? So you're almost going to go through every part of the body and just, you know, slowly touching the body, maybe lightly with your just your arm on the child's shoulder or back or leg, because conveying your presence is so important, and just going slowly. So this step is just breathing. It's almost like you want the child's breathing to come in alignment with your breathing, or to entrain to your breathing rhythm as you're calming down and you're waiting for the child to calm down. Now, step five, it could, as the child is calming down, sometimes what happens is there's a release of emotion, which can come with a bit of crying or trembling or just, you know, maybe words. What you want to do here is help that emotion continue to be released. So you say, yeah, you know, just accept everything. That's right. It's scary. That was upsetting. Yes, it hurts. Let yourself cry. That's good. You know, it'll make it better. We don't want to stop the child by saying things like, it's okay, don't worry, it's all over now, you don't have to cry, it's okay. Like, we certainly don't want to stop the feelings. What we want to do is let the feelings of being shaken up, of being frightened, we want those feelings to come through the body and to be released. So when they're there, we can say it again, yeah, that was pretty scary, that was pretty upsetting. And by naming that, we're not making things worse. What we're doing is we're inviting the feelings that are inside the child to come out. That's what we want them. We don't want them staying inside, because when they stay inside, they can be forming part of that trauma circuit in the child's brain. So step six is just providing your presence again, a calming voice, a reassuring light touch, and giving the child comfort and space. It's important not to really squeeze a child tight when he's in a traumatized state. If the child needs to be held, letting him sit lightly on your lap with an arm, again, lightly around him, is actually better for the release of the trauma in his body than holding him very tightly. I mean, our instinct might be to hold a little child very tightly. What we're trying to do is squeeze the trauma away. That's what we want to do. But what is best for the child is to have enough space around of himself or herself that the body can shake the trauma off. So we don't want to sort of shut it down and shut it in. We just want the child to feel just a little bit of space, so that if the child can tremble it off or move it off, or breathe it off, whatever it is, that he's physically free to let that energy move. Step seven is to encourage the child to rest, even though a lot of times kids do not want to rest. After they've had a fright, an upset, whatever it is, they're ready to go play, or they want to get on with life. It's actually good for them to have a little bit more rest, because that helps heal the body after trauma. Now, the last step, step eight, is to tell the story of the traumatic event. So that doesn't happen until all the trauma is out of the child's body. So we don't really want to run up to a child and start with step eight. What happened? What happened? What were you doing? What was going on? How did that happen? Okay, we don't want to tell that story at step one. Okay, this is the very last thing, and it can happen hours after the actual event occurred. And it's fine if it happens the next day. Okay, so what happened there on the playground? You were climbing up, and did your foot trip, or you know what went on? And then let the child tell you the story, and you tell the child the story back. When it's told in this non-traumatized state, it completes the whole process for the child of the experience of moving through a stressful event. The child is able to tell the story and put it in the right part of his brain. When the child is in a trauma state, information does not get stored properly at that time because the brain is geared for survival and to process. It doesn't process information in the regular way. We actually just get little fragments. We don't get the whole story. We get the frightening highlights. The brain is not operating in its normal way when adrenaline is still running through the body. That's why we're going to do the storytelling about it a little bit later and send it to the hippocampus, the part of the brain that remembers events and stores them properly for reference later. So, and we'll do this afterwards. Now, the more often we go through these steps, and you can see that some of the steps are overlapping, and a lot of them have to do with just going slowly, calming down, being present. I've called them 1, 2, 3, 4 up to 8 because that's how Dr. Levine calls them, but you can see that in action, it's really just a matter of slow welcoming of the child's experience and being with the child, being present with the child enough to help the child process his own feelings. And by doing that, the child is able to clear the feelings and lay down this neural pathway in his brain for doing that for all upsetting events. Now, there's lots to be upset about in life, and when the child has this process of tuning into his own body, noticing how he's feeling, allowing those feelings to happen, and thereby clearing them out of his system, then the child is trauma-proof. So if you want to read more about that, you can actually take a look at Dr. Levine's book, which is in fact called, let me see here, Trauma-Proofing Your Kids, by Peter A. Levine. So you can take a look at that. But we've got the basics right here, so you're ready now to help your child in any circumstance.